بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين Dear brothers and sisters, سلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته And welcome to this new course which pertains to the subject of خمس. خمس is one of the عبادات, one of the acts of worship in Islam. Together with Salat, with fasting, Sawm, Hajj, Zakat, and other principles that we have. Khums is another of the Ibadat. And being Ibadat, it has to be done with the intention to gain proximity to Allah. It has to be done for the sake of Allah, like the Salat and the Sawm and other subsidiary actions that we have and ibadat that we have in Islam. Although the subject of khums contains a lot of esoteric dimensions, the primary focus in this course is that of the letter of the law, and we're going to concern ourselves primarily with the fiqhi jurisprudential aspects, the exoteric aspects of the khums. And one of the reasons for focusing primarily on the jurisprudential dimensions of the khums is because it's a subject, an area, which is less focused upon. The focus that we have in relation to other ibadat, we see this focus to a lesser degree when it comes to the khums. But khums is very important. Like with other actions within Islam, this khums has a lot of important aspects to it, and inshallah we're going to primarily focus on the outer aspects, but now and again, maybe one or two sentences per session, we may touch upon the esoteric dimensions too, the rationale and the philosophies behind it. That which is important is that it was through khums, and it still is, that the Islamic propagation revived itself, grew and developed in the era of formation during the initial years of the mission of the Holy Messenger. And even in the first and second centuries, it was through the Khums, this capital of Khums, that was essential for Islamic propagation. At the end of the day, for Islamic propagation to succeed, there are many parameters that are involved. One of them is financial. One of them pertains to capital. I'm not saying that is the be-all and end-all, but it's one of the parameters. And so here we see that the paying of the khums, and inshallah we'll go through the definition and what it is and so on and so forth over time, but the actual paying of the khums was something crucial, especially in the earlier years, for the development of Islam. And it still is today. And today, one can establish a relationship with the imam of the time through the khums. And if you want to evaluate yourself in this regard, if you want to ask yourself, how much am I doing for Islam? One of the ways that you can evaluate yourself in relation to how much you are contributing to Islam and how much of a relationship you are having, a positive, true relationship with the 12th Imam, you can evaluate yourself through how much focus, importance, and attentiveness you are paying to this tenet of the khums. The more it is, the better your situation is. The lesser, the worse. And inshallah, this will become clear as we go through the lectures, inshallah. So let's start the course, and we'll start with a verse from the Holy Quran, chapter 8, verse 41. Now, there's only one explicit mention of the khums in the Holy Quran. But you shouldn't think to yourself that since there's only one mention, it's not an important principle. It's not an important subject. Some things which are important may have not been mentioned in the Quran explicitly, because the enemy may have then tried to get rid of that subject or to get rid of that verse. Now, yes, Allah has protected the Quran. The Quran we have today is the same Quran revealed to the Holy Messenger. But this protecting, this divine protection of the book has its own ways. And one of the ways may include not mentioning sensitive areas too much within the Quran, because it may cause disunity or people trying to do away with those verses. And that's why when it comes, for example, to the successorship of the Holy Messenger, there was no mention in the Quran explicitly. With the khums too, one shouldn't think this is not an important matter. It's very important. Its importance lies in many parameters, one of which is that the medium, one of the media through which Islam grows is through finance. And here, the paying of the khums enables Islamic propagation to maximize. Now here, naturally, if you're an enemy of Islam, you would want to go against the khums. And that is what has happened. And we have du'as and supplications which refer to this reality, to how the enemies, what the enemies would do for the sake of barring, inhibiting the purpose behind the khums. As I say, inshallah, over time, we'll go through certain areas. But khums is a reality. It existed from the time of the Holy Messenger. And even there's a very historical argument, very legitimate historical argument, that the khums even existed before Islam amongst the Arabs. But anyway, that which Islam brought, that one-fifth, which is the literal definition of khums, that one-fifth that the Islam has brought has its own color. And from the time of the Holy Messenger, it existed, and it existed through the eras of the succeeding leaders after the Holy Messenger. They all had this. The khums was always there. And any historian, any historical analysis in this matter can easily prove this. Although I'm not a historian and we're not going to go through the history, but it's a good area for those who are interested to delve in this area and read upon it. So we'll start with the verse in the Holy Quran which explicitly mentions the khums, and that is chapter 8, verse 41. وَاعْلَمُوا أَنَّ مَا غَنِمْتُمْ مِنْ شَيْءٍ فَأَنَّ لِلَّهِ خُمُسَهُ وَلِلرَّسُولِ وَلِذِي الْقُرْبَى وَالْيَتَامَى وَالْمَسَاكِينِ وَابْنِ السَّبِيلِ إِنْ كُنْتُمْ آمَنْتُمْ بِاللَّهِ. Although I haven't read the whole verse, but this was the main part of the verse which I want to cover. A loose translation would be, and know that whatever thing you gain or acquire, a fifth of it is for Allah and for the Messenger and for the near of kin and the orphans and the needy and the stranded traveller if you believe in Allah. Now, here this was just a translation of the verse. Now let's go through the different segments of the verse and analyze them a bit more carefully now, scrutinizing them. It starts with the verse starts with an imperative and no. This no, strictly speaking, is an imperative. So if you want to be very pedantic, you should add a exclamation mark after the word no, indicating it's an imperative. So this is when something, first of all, it's the first word in this verse, and it's starting with an imperative. The fact that it starts with an imperative shows that it's an order, and therefore it's obligatory for you to know. It's so important that it's like a mandatory command for you to know what is to succeed. And when a verse starts with this and know, it indicates the sentence which is to succeed is a very important sentence. When you look through the verses of the Holy Quran, there are two verses, as far as my very deficient research has shown, maybe I may be wrong, but there are two verses which start with this command of and know. Yes, in the middle of many verses, you see wa'lamu in the Holy Quran. But at the very outset of the verse, we only observe this in two cases. This was the first. The second is chapter 8, Anfal, the same chapter as the Khums verse. Verse number 28. And that reads, and know that your amwal, now amwal, let's translate it very loosely for now as property, although the translation is something else, and since amwal is something we are going to be talking about at some length, I'll leave it until then. So, and know that your amwal, your property, and your children are but a trial, a test. And verily before Allah is a mighty reward. This is the translation of the other verse, which also at the outset starts with wa'lamu. And the verse reads, wa'lamu annama amwalukum wa awladukum. Tests are being referred to. Now this is used in the absolute sense here. There are many tests that we have in relation to our property, in relation to our amwal. One of those is the khums. And it's interesting that this test of the khums, it's explicitly mentioned in chapter 8, verse 41, but it's implicitly mentioned, or it's implicitly referred to as one application of amwal. So this amwal is a test for you. You have to encounter it with a particular protocol. It may apply to many things, but one of those applications is your khums, because the subject matter of khums is pertaining to amwal in general. Because in that verse, verse number 41, whatever you gain, a fifth of it is for Allah. A fifth of it is for Allah, is for the messenger, is for the near of kin, and then three other groups have been mentioned. So here, although I'll come to this next point in a minute, I don't want to rush things, and So there, it was in relation to, it was a test in verse number 41. It is a test for you, you doing your duty to the imam of the era, to the khalifa of today, in this way that a fifth of whatever you gain today is his. This is a test for you. In verse number 28, it's not explicitly mentioned, but it's more generally mentioned as amwal, and that's in verse 28. A few verses later, in verse 41, that general protocol is now specified, or at least one application of it is specified. And in this second verse, where your speaks of your amwal in general terms being a test for you, it then ends by saying, verily, before Allah. Look, verily, if you want to go very literally translated, it will be translated as, verily, Allah, before him is a mighty reward. This station of being before Allah is a very high station. It's higher than the reward of this physical realm. It's higher than the realm of the semi-immaterial dimension of existence. It's higher than the immaterial dimension of existence. The physical, semi-immaterial, and immaterial realms of existence are all created realms. They're all created. They have a beginning and end. However, when in the realm of indahu, in the realm of being before Allah, that's in a non-created realm. For example, the realm of Allah's attributes. And here, in this non-created realm of existence, here, this test, one of which is the khums, were you to succeed, you can detach yourself from the created realms of existence and connect to the non-created realms of existence, because the reward is in dahu, is before Allah. You're in the vicinity of Allah, subhanahu wa ta'ala. Now here, one can speak a lot, and there are many verses suggesting this, but I don't. The main focus here is not any kind of non-jurisprudential interpretation of the verses. Okay. Then, continuing with the verse, the segments that we want to closely scrutinize. So, wa'lamu, the point was that it's in addition to the fact that it's an imperative and it's suggesting importance because it's a command given, but it's also mentioned at the outset of the verse. So it shows, look, it's telling the reader, this content which you're about to read is of utmost practical importance. All the verses of the Quran are important, but some things are in relation to you executing them, you practicing them. And this is one of the reasons why this is important, because there's a practical protocol given. Then it says, anna. So, wa'lamu, and know, anna. That verily. Now, this verily is a particle of emphasis, and it is indicating emphasis in relation to the matter at stake. So, look, wa'lamu also was indicating that the succeeding content is very important. And now we have indicating that this is there's an emphatic aspect to this verse. There's emphasizing to the reader that, look, this is very important. So, wa'lamu, and know, Anna, verily. Then the next segment, anything you gain, anything you gain, anything you acquire. It's used in the absolute sense here. So whatever you gain, because some denominations in Islam, all denominations of Islam have the khums. But when it comes to the applications of the khums and what the khums is levied upon, those things upon which the khums is levied, some denominations in Islam, they say that the only area where the khums is levied is that of the war booty, that which is gained at times of war. And actually in this very verse, the context was the Battle of Badr, which was during the earlier years of the mission in Medina when this happened. Now, where this battle was realized. Now, here, this is just one application of where the khums is levied. But here, ghanimtum literally means anything that you gain. War booty is just one application of gain. But it's not the literal translation of ghanimtum. It's not specific to a war booty gain. It can be used with many forms of gain. And also, although this, I don't want to go into tafsir too much, but this ghanimtum has been used in many contexts, even in the same verse towards the end, but in relation to a context other than the war booty. Not khums, the term ghanimtum, that anything you gain, has been used in another context from war, other than war. So here, to make it specific to the war booty, you're not doing justice to the Quran. You're limiting the Islamic message of the Quran. It's a very limited picture, whereas that which Khums has in mind is much greater than just the gain of the war booty. So here, when you look at the verse, minus the historical context, it means anything that you gain. When you look at it in a historical context, one of its applications is the war booty. But that doesn't prevent you from applying it to any other context, unless a contradiction will arise if you do use it in the absolute sense. There may be exceptions, for example. Then, with whatever you gain, the verse says, it is for Allah. It's Allah's. Whatever you gain, it's Allah's. It's not yours. A fifth of it is Allah's. A fifth of it is not yours. In relation to whatever you gain, a fifth of it is Allah's. And then it says, and for the messenger. So it starts by saying, this one-fifth of whatever you gain is for Allah. Lillah, for Allah, or it's Allah's. Then, and for the messenger, or it's the messenger's. That one-fifth is the messenger's. And the third, it says, and for, look, the word for, lillah, lirrasul, wa lidhil ghurba. In all these three groups or three entities, the preposition, the lam preposition, has been mentioned. One of the meanings of the lam preposition is the meaning of ownership. Now, I'll come to that in a minute. But here, we see that in relation to Allah, in relation to the messenger, in relation to the near of kin, the dhil ghurba, all of them are preceded by the preposition lam. And this lam of ownership only precedes these three entities, showing that Allah is the owner, the messenger is the owner, the dhil ghurba, the near of kin, is the owner. Now, the absolute owner is Allah, period. We only have one owner, and that is Allah. Now, Allah then establishes a Khalifa on earth, which was the Holy Messenger, and then gives his ownership rights to the Holy Messenger. And after the Holy Messenger gives it to the successors to the Holy Messenger. So here we see that during the time of the Holy Messenger, that the Holy Messenger was the owner of the Khums. And during the time of the near of kin, although we'll speak about that in a minute, they are the owner of the Khums. Why do I say they are the owner? Because of the lam preposition preceding these three entities. Now, Allah doesn't have physical hands. He's given this duty to the Khalifa, who's a manifestation of Allah's attributes on earth. That was the Holy Messenger. So Allah has Allah's share goes to the Holy Messenger. The Holy Messenger's share is his, and the near of kin who existed at the time of the Holy Messenger, but since the Holy Messenger is living and present, his share is also the Holy Messenger's, out of etiquette at least. And so three of the six shares are now under the control of the Messenger, but the Messenger is the owner. The Messenger is the owner of this Khums. But then three other groups are mentioned after. But the lam preposition is not seen with those three groups. And so there we don't call those three groups the owner of the Khums. We treat those in a different way. I'll come to that in a minute. So it's for Allah, the Messenger, and the near of kin. Now this near of kin, the dhil qurba, look, it doesn't say dhil qaraba. Or in other verses of the Holy Quran, when family is mentioned in very broad terms, you see different conjugations of the root word qurb being mentioned. But dhil qurba is referring to a specific group amongst the family, the near of kin. And here, with the help of traditions and ahadith, they are the successors to the Holy Prophet. Those who are of the near of kin and who succeeded the Holy Prophet, they are too the owners of the Khums. And today, the owner of the Khums is the Mahdi. May Allah expedite his advent, is the Mahdi, and now he is the owner. And we have this extraordinary privilege to be in partnership, in ownership, partners in ownership with such a Khalifa on earth. This is just showing the importance of the matter. And since the Mahdi is an occultation, the general representatives of this successor, this honourable successor, are the fuqaha, the jurists, and the, although here one can speak a lot, and over time I will mention about this, but the jurists, the most learned jurists, they are taking this responsibility upon themselves. Not that they are the owner is the Mahdi. But these jurists are representing the Mahdi. They are like the acting on his behalf. And so they have a say in how this Khums has to be spent, for example. So what we see so far is that six of the shares, three of them pertain to the Holy Messenger at the time of the Holy Messenger. And in these three shares, the Khums is spent on Islamic propagation. Anything to do with the spread of Islam. And here, one of the responsibilities of the jurist is to make sure that the money is spent for the Islamic cause. This is very important. Something, you have to spend it on something that you have certitude that the Mahdi, may Allah expedite his advent, is pleased with, is satisfied with. And that's how it was spent from day one of Islam. And that's why it had so many enemies. They knew. You imagine, a fifth of everything you gain, if it gets to the hand of the Prophet, how he's going to spend. And then how the enemies are now saying, look, we have to do something about this. Otherwise, they're going to get the upper hand. So, with the first three entities mentioned, Allah, the Messenger, the near of kin, the lam proposition, le, the lillah, lirrasul, lidil qurba. Here, you see that they were all preceded with this particle, this preposition of ownership. So they are the owners. But then the verse reads, and mentions three other shares, three other groups. And the orphans, the needy and the stranded traveller. Now, all these have definitions. We'll come to these definitions of what do we mean? Who is the needy? What is meant by an orphan in jurisprudential terms? Who is the stranded traveller in jurisprudential terms? Because with these definitions, there are conditions. They're not just, we shouldn't just take the literal definition. We're looking at the technical definition also. So, and this verse pertains to, it's one of the 500 verses which speak of jurisprudence in the Quran. And therefore, we have to look at it in a particular light. What was meant by the stranded traveller? Who is the stranded traveller? And so on and so forth. But that which is important right now is that with these three groups, these three groups are not the owners of the khums. These three groups are just applications of expenditure. They're not indicative of these three groups being the owner. You see, in zakat, here, that zakat, the ownership, it what is specified to the needy. Although the needy is one of the applications of the zakat, but it's specified, one of the applications, it says the owner is the needy. And in many, here, therefore, since the owner is the needy, and as I say, those who are needy or poor, they have a specific definition. We'll come to that another time. But they are the owners. And so with our zakat, or in most applications of the zakat, we don't need the permission of anyone to give the zakat to the needy. We can give it to them. They are a rightful owner of the zakat. It is for them. However, with khums, the needy, according to the more common interpretation, the needy in khums are not the rightful owners of the khums. The rightful owner is the khalifa of the era. But here, the needy are one of the three applications of expenditure where you spend the khums. So this khums is spent for the Islamic cause, three out of the six shares of expenditure is for the Islamic cause, and another three of the applications of expenditure, it's for the needy orphan, the needy person in general, and the needy stranded traveller. Although with these three, there's one other condition. They have to be Sayyid. And we'll explain what Sayyid means in a minute. So that is one condition, and they have to be needy. Now, be they an orphan or a stranded traveller or neither of the two, they're just needy. And they have to be Sayyid. These three groups are applications of expenditure. So three out of the six shares, the application of expenditure has been specified, and the other three is for the Islamic cause. But the owner is the Khalifa of the time. And that's why when you want to spend for the Islamic cause, the Khalifa of the time, and today the representatives of the Khalifa of the time, which are the most learned jurists, they, since they are most learned in Islam, they know what are the needs of Islam. They know what is the priorities of what Islam needs today. Is it education, health, jihad, and so on and so forth, defense. And so we see that here, with the religious authorities, the most learned jurists, the religious authorities, they are representatives of the Khalifa of the time. So since the Khalifa of the time is the owner and has given this ownership in general terms to the religious authority, in general terms, not that they are the owner, but they are representing that ownership of the Khalifa of the time, when it comes to the three shares of the Islamic cause, you have to get permission, and you have to give the khums to them. You can't spend for the Islamic cause yourself. Firstly, because you're not the owner. They are the owner. So they have to spend it. And if you want to spend it in something that you believe is an Islamic cause and is of benefit to Islam, you have to get their permission. And if they don't grant their permission, you can't go and say, let's go and find someone, another jurist, who may give us permission. That would be very problematic. You would be playing around with the Khalifa of the time. So here, you have to get their permission. Even in relation to those three applications of expenditure, there too, theoretically, since the owner is the Khalifa of the time and the religious authority is representing them, you had, even there, you would have to get permission. So either you give the fifth of whatever you gain, your khums, to the religious authority, and if you wanted to spend it yourself on the latter three groups, the applications of expenditure on the needy or the orphans or the stranded travellers, you would have to get the permission from the religious authority. You can't do it yourself. Now, sometimes maybe the religious authority, in relation to the latter three applications of expenditure, even though they are representing the ownership of the Khalifa of the time, they may, in very open terms and free terms, say, I leave it to the duty bound. They can spend a half of their khums, three out of the six shares, on the latter three applications of expenditure. It's okay. I give you that permission. You are free to do it. But if they don't give such an open permission, you would have to give your khums to the religious authority. The whole khums, not half of it, the whole of it. And if there is an Islamic cause, or if you know needy people in your community and you want to give it to them, it's okay, but you have to get the permission from the religious authority. Don't play around with your religion in this regard. This is important. Some people may have a very difficult time doing this because they earn a lot and now they feel they have the upper hand and they want to choose for themselves how to spend their khums. This is playing with fire. This is a satanic deception which is overcoming them, which is dominating them. One of the philosophies of the khums is that detachment, that utmost detachment from one's wealth, from one's property. And some people, they don't have that. And this causes a lot of problems because it shows they're not doing it for Allah's sake, period, either. And so even though on the outside they're giving their khums, on the inside they still haven't given their khums. And this causes a lot of spiritual problems. One argument for this part of the verse, which says that infers that these are applications of expenditure, and that the orphans, the needy, the stranded travelers are not the owners like the needy were in relation to zakat, is that if they were truly the owners, and let's say you had £500, if you had £500 and there's one orphan, there's one needy, and there's one stranded traveler, let's imagine there are only these three, one of each, you would then have to divide that £500 into three equal groups and give it to them, if those three were rightful owners of the khums, whereas that's not the case. Or imagine the expenditure for all these latter three groups is £1 million, and you now, when you've received the khums of everyone, you have £5 million. If now with 1 million, you've satiated the latter three applications of expenditure. But if those latter three were not seen as applications of expenditure, but rather were seen as the rightful owners, so what are you going to do with the surplus £4 million? What are you going to do with that? Because we'll come to the conditions associated with these latter three. You can't give them too much. You only have to give them to the level that they come out of poverty. And that poverty has a strict jurisprudential definition, which we'll come to one day. What are you going to do with the surplus? The answer is the surplus goes to the imam of the time, the khalifa of the time. And then they, with that surplus, because they've satiated the needs of the latter three groups, they spend it on the Islamic cause and on anything else that they feel that is necessary. They may even spend it for non-Sayyid needy people. That is for the Islamic cause. That is open for the religious authority to decide upon. But if they were the rightful owners, what are you going to do with the extra four million? So it's problematic, this opinion. It's not complete. Rather, on a par with the logic of this verse, that which is more deserving of attention is that preposition of ownership, which has come to Allah, the messenger, and the near of kin being the successors. For example, Imam Ali, alayhi salam, then Imam Hassan, alayhi salam, Imam Hussein, alayhi salam, and so on and so forth. So this was the verse. So now we come to the definition of the khums, the definition given in jurisprudence, and the definition is this now. Now you should understand this definition much better given the introduction that we've gone through. The khums is defined technically in jurisprudence as a right in mal, which is the singular of amwal. It's a right in property, but property isn't the best translation. But to explain what the translation is, I have to go through an introduction. We'll do that in the next session, inshallah. The khums is a right in property, canonically, sharia-wise, assigned, made obligatory by Allah, for himself, for the messenger, and for the near of kin, the near of kin being those in whom lie leadership and the attributes of excellence for the propagation of religion. And then it goes through the applications, and for spending it amongst specific categories of people, amongst the Hashemites, but this is, so it's amongst the Hashemites. So it's a right in property, assigned by Allah for himself, the messenger and the near of kin, and it's vis-a-vis only certain forms of property. We'll come to what those seven groups of property are later. And it's a right over his servants, over Allah's servants. So it's a long definition. And some people may say, why is it limited to the Hashemites? In these latter three groups, why is it limited to the Hashemites? And first of all, who are the Hashemites, the Sayyids that we call today? These Hashemites, who are they? Well, the Hashemites, or those commonly referred to as Sayyids, are those whose paternal lineage can be traced back to Hashim, the great grandfather of the Holy Messenger. So Amirul Mu'mineen, Imam Ali alayhi salam, is also a Hashemite, because through his father, who was Abu Talib, and then Abu Talib's father was Abdul Muttalib, then Abdul Muttalib's father was Hashim, whereas the Holy Prophet, his father was Abdullah, and then Abdullah was the son of Abdul Muttalib, and then Abdul Muttalib was the son of Hashim. So you see how they so Imam Ali, his paternal lineage to Hashim goes through Abu Talib, who is the brother of Abdullah, but Abdullah and Abu Talib, they do it through their link, their being traced to Hashim, is through Abdul Muttalib, the grandfather of the Holy Messenger. So they're regarded as Hashemites. Now, in the definition, we said, because the Hashemites, the message of Islam grew, developed initially, was formed initially through the medium of the Hashemites. The message was first given to through the Hashemites. So Islam grew through them. And for the first 2 to 3 centuries, we see this. And that's why the Hashemites were under extreme forces of oppression in these 2 or 3 centuries of Islam. The Hashemites, Islam grew through them, and this responsibility was upon them. It was upon all Muslims, but more upon them. They were a chosen people. The Prophet was chosen from the Hashemi clan. We can't escape this. This is how Islam grew. It's a historical fact. So Islam doesn't turn a blind eye over those who had a more influential role in relation to its spread and dissemination. And even in traditions, we see if a Hashemite sins, the sin will be counted as 2 because of the responsibility they have. We have this in other groups of people too. If a scholar was to sin, it's on a par with 70 sins of a non-scholar. Look, it's all about responsibility here. So with the Hashemites, even today, we see this responsibility. They have this responsibility, more so than non-Hashemites. Now, someone may say, well, is this a caste system, like many other religions may have? No one is saying the Hashemite is a higher person. They're saying their responsibility is more. Otherwise, in traditions and in the ahadith, there are numerous ahadith which makes you a higher person in the hereafter is your actions, is taqwa. And even Hashemites may end up in level 7 of hell that we have. With these caste systems that we see today in certain distorted religions, they have an intrinsic value. The actual person, the value intrinsically is a lot. Whereas in Islam, it's an historical fact, but that historical fact just adds responsibility, not them having an intrinsic higher worth. Because many Sayyids, many Hashemites from day one until today, they will end in hell because they don't have taqwa. So here we have to look at it very carefully and not, you know, kind of misjudge the situation and think Islam has a kind of caste system. And it's not as if the non-Hashimi needy people are suffering. No, they have their share from the zakat. And as I said before, there's always a surplus for the religious authority in the khums, and that can also go to the non-Hashimi needy people. It's theoretically allowed. Okay, so we'll stop here, and inshallah in the next session we're going to start and dissect the term amwal. You should have the notes before you. It may be worth reading them before we start in the next session next week. But until then, if there are any questions, don't hesitate to send them, and we'll try to answer them in the next session, inshallah. وصلى الله على محمد وآله الطاهرين.